Polish?
Have you ever been to Poland?
Ah, I have been, not in this life.
Not in this life?
Except in YouTube.
Right.
To be somewhere, you don't need to be there physically anymore.
Do you have any relatives or any ancestors from Poland, maybe? That you know of?
Not that I know of, but I remember one of... I still remember his name from school, my primary school, Jerzy Sahaki. Does that sound Polish?
One more time.
Jerzy Sahaki. That's a 6 or 7 year old, how would they pronounce him, his name? But he was like from Poland.
Alright.
A long time ago.
Oh, did you play soccer with him?
Yeah.
Alright.
Yeah.
Would you like to come to Poland?
My likes and dislikes are not part of the equation.
Okay.
These days I have to do what is possible.
The Theravada Foundation that I represent, maybe we can all send you an official invitation one day. So
yes, you can send an official invitation. But I just even a couple of days ago, it was a very strong invitation to go over to Vietnam. And I said, I can't do that because it's just too many invitations. What they said was that, please, all your books are very popular over there. And there's lots of people who would really benefit from your teachings. And I think that's what you would ask me as well.
And the gentleman from Poland, and it's really quite a big following.
I've been there. So can you tell us, how did Bodhinyana start?
It started when we were desperate for a cup of coffee. We were looking at some piece of land quite a distance from here. And on the way back, we passed a real estate agent. And the real estate agent here in Byford, close by, the last time we went to ask if anything was there, he gave us a cup of coffee. So it was just trying to get a cup of coffee. And so we went there, had a cup of coffee, and was one of his friends was there and said, oh, I remember this piece of land they could not sell a few years ago, no one wanted it. And that might be just the place for you. And of course it was. So this is very good, anyone in business, please understand that, you know, if you give your clients just a cup of coffee, it's really good for business. Especially if it's two Buddhist monks or coming by looking for something. So anyway, it's called the law of karma. You're kind to other people and you get good rewards back. So anyway, there we were looking for land. So we got this place and no one else wanted it and we couldn't afford it, which usually happens. And so we made an offer which should have been refused because it was way under what was asked for. But the person there, he was an old fellow. He could not find his sheep and cows when they grazed here because it was just too hilly. So there's too many places here you can just escape and hide. And that's perfect, you know, for what we were looking for. So we got it. But that was the start of our problems because we had no money. In fact, we were in debt. So, and no places to stay. It was just empty land. Great for cows and kangaroos, but not for people. So the first day I came here, that I could not find where I'd put my place to stay, so I slept under a tree, literally. No blankets, no pillows, nothing, just on the ground. So just like the good old days, we started from the very, very basics. Little by little, we worked very hard. It was always one brick at a time. You never had great plans, you know, how it's going to be in the future. And in fact, we just, when we had a bit of money, we did some work, and then we built little by little. And after many, many years, I think one of the first things was people found out that we were serious. We weren't just going to come in and then just disappear. We were in this for the long term. So that's one of the reasons why even the first buildings we built were really solid. We could have put up tents and just caravans, but that would be giving the wrong impression. And that meant that people, after a while, they realized that, yeah, these monks are going to stay here. And started giving teachings as well and meditating. But it wasn't just teachings and meditating, it was just how we live those teachings in our life. We're actually practicing them. And that impressed people. So little by little, we managed to build up a community here.
And then came Jhana Grove.
Jhana Grove, yeah, because we did have some people meditating. But the problem was that here you had the monastic life as well, and it could not be a meditation center and a monastery at the same time, because you know, there's other little things we have to do, like giving interviews, which would disturb a meditation center, and you know, other little ceremonies which we have to do. And a beautiful the way that you know, you've seen that we have our lunch here, which is you know, inspiring. And quite often you ask them, why do you do this? And they say, because we get so much inspiration and joy out of this. And it answers the question, why is it that, you know, the monks, we could actually be self-sufficient. You know, we could just grow some gardens and cook our own food. But it's missing out on something, the connection and the beautiful act of generosity of giving and receiving, which makes this Theravada system work. So, no, we don't put a, we've got a wall, but we've got gates always open. We don't sort of seclude ourselves and have nothing to do with the lay community. And we come in for a certain time during the day to connect, which I think is a very beautiful way of, the Buddha said, you know, that we should depend upon the generosity of lay people. And it also means it's a sense of, if we don't provide a good service, you know, if we're not good monks, then people won't feed us. So it's a little like a safety mechanism there. If you misbehave, then you'll get very thin. Because we're doing such a good job, that's why I'm very sad. It's just what you can expect.
So Jhana Grove?
And Jhana Grove, yes. So we wanted a meditation retreat center. And so, again, saw a nice place over there. And again, as we collected some money for it, again, never enough, we bought the land. And then later on, we decided, yeah, let's build a retreat center. And as usual, that, you know, getting permissions and getting this and getting that, it was just never enough funds. We said, oh, what the heck, just do it. And the funds came later on, as they normally do, at the last minute. Because I remember just looking after that and just getting this huge bill for about $300,000 or $400,000. How the heck am I going to pay for that? Impossible. But then, you know, a bit of asking around here and asking around there, borrowing from this and borrowing from that, you know, managed to actually to get enough to pay the builder. That was very, very, very tight at the last moment. But it was just, even the process is very beautiful. And lastly, just the to have the ambience of the place, a nice peaceful little island surrounded by forest. And if you look at the aerial picture of it, you can understand that you know, it's a little island of an open area, and just forest on all sides. And it's got beautiful feng shui, nice views over the ocean, and it's a very peaceful place. So people love it there.
Okay, and then was Dhammasara?
Dhammasara, that was the next thing that we had. You know, where are the women? And you know, you can't. It doesn't make any sense to me. And it's also the fact that these days, that actually even the old days, that you know there was still equity and fairness. This is, it's not just a modern movement. Even in the time of the Buddha, and may all beings be happy and well. You know, it's always all beings. It's not just men. It's not just Asians. It's not just healthy, strong beings. It's all beings. And there's a wonderful little idea there that you know, you should never discriminate according to gender, sexual orientation, or even just health or age. A person can do it, obviously, give them a chance. So anyways, so because of that, I decided that you know we should really as much as possible open the doors to you know, all beings. And with that came the idea of just knowing, just in tradition, it's always been the case. Whenever there is a woman's community alongside a men's community, it's always the men who dominated. And so I didn't want that to happen. I just wanted the women just to prove that, you know, they could do whatever the men could do, so give them their own community. And they've really lived up to you know, my hopes. And that give them their own community. It's also at the same time it means that this place is to the south of Perth, the south of the city. The Dhammasara Nuns Monastery is to the east of the city. So you know, we're spreading ourselves around, so you know we can serve a greater part of the community in Perth. With Dhammasara, it was just building the place first of all, and then the next part was the ordination of the nuns, which was resisted tooth and nail by many parts of Buddhism. And I will not say by the traditionalists, because I always say I am a traditionalist Theravada Buddhist. So you quote back from the earliest texts, you know, what the Buddha would do and how the Buddha set up everything. So you know, I'm more fundamentalist. So you know, go back to the earliest and justify everything. The other ones are just pandering to parts of Buddhism, or rather culture, which came much later, after the time of the Buddha. And so what they think is tradition is actually just the last 200, 300, 400, 500 years. And so that was wonderful to have the bhikkhuni ordination here. And that made a lot of people even more inspired and respect Theravada Buddhism. That we were showing leadership in areas which needed leadership, especially to have equity and respect for all genders.
So can you say that this Buddhist monastery and the BSW area is the avant-garde of the Theravada movement?
No, it's just so traditional. It's so just. Harking back to the original teachings of the Buddha. And so, by doing so, it's fascinating that it's regarded as avant-garde, or it's regarded as progressive. It's regarded as respecting modern times. It's respecting modern times and ancient times. Compassion has got no age limit. It's not fashionable in one area and unfashionable in another area. Meditation just, it works no matter sort of what sexual orientation, what age, what anything. So the heart of Buddhism is timeless, ageless, beyond fashion. You know, it's just basic kindness, compassion.
And so you can say by going back to the early stage, we're actually moving forward.
Exactly.
Bhante, you had some problems with the ordination. Can you just go?
The ordination, there was just reactions to the ordination. And so you did get the word was at the time, can't really call it excommunicated, or that's what they thought it was, because that's not done according to the rule of the Vinaya. And so some people call it expulsion. But these days I call it liberated, you know, from sort of a group. You know, which was well-meaning, but really not well-informed. They're living in a tiny world. And because of that, but I think little by little they start to see that that's not really a tenable way to live their life and to make Buddhism popular, which is part of our job. The Buddha said, just go, and no two by the same way for the benefit and happiness of all living beings. More people.
Right. So, okay, maybe we can talk a little bit about meditation.
Yes.
So, just now you've been giving so many stories, so I'll give a short story. Okay, there was a Polish monk in 2011.
Yeah.
He went to your retreat.
Yes.
And he tried really hard to get the jhanas. You probably have heard so many stories about that.
Indeed.
And at the end of the retreat, he was like, oh, I'm a failure.
Yeah, bro.
Classic, right?
You're welcome then, to Western psychology.
Right. Then he went back to the Kuti in his monastery and just sat there and just like...
Gave up.
And then he saw breath in the body.
Yeah.
And that was a very good meditation, you might say. But the question is, because you're going to, you're teaching the jhanas, which is like, I call it classical jhanas, which is like, well, nimitta and no sense, no senses and stuff like that. In Kayagata Sati Sutta, in Majjhima Nikaya, there is this passage where there are jhanas and there is the, they are in the body, you might say.
Yeah, so, they use the word body, but it's the same as Anapanasati, the breath. But when you go deep into the meditation, you're not watching the breath anymore. You know, you're watching the piti-sukha, just the joy. You're watching the citta. And then you're liberating all these things. So, you know, sometimes people need to really get their heads around Pali and also all of the idioms. And I've often actually made sort of comparisons, you know, with, I don't know about much about Polish, but with English, and the crazy idioms they have in English. It rained cats and dogs. So that means, in England, you get a big shower, and all these kittens, and these puppies, and these dogs come down from the sky. Of course it doesn't mean that. Because a word means different things in different contexts. Just one of the things which comes up is like, just because there was a crossword puzzle the other day, thrush. What is thrush? It's a bird, but it's also a disease of the throat. So, you know, but in different contexts, it means totally different things. So that's why that sometimes the word kaya, and it's something which has totally different meanings in different contexts.
I've talked to many people who were having a good meditation and their base was body.
Yeah.
So the thing is, and this is me talking from a compassionate point of view, that they might strive really hard to get the classical jhanas.
They go nowhere. The people just, you know, we're almost brainwashed into thinking that to get anywhere you have to strive. Now, it's the case that even the history of Buddhism should actually give you some examples of that, some indication. There was Siddhartha Gautama 6 years striving, getting nowhere, just getting frustrated, you know, almost about to give up. And part of the striving was just being really the tough guy. And so when he decided to eat properly and just, you know, become a bit more compassionate to his body, that then his friends thought he'd just given up, he stopped striving. And that's actually where that he found his other path, that middle way. It wasn't about striving, it was about using the wisdom power, the kindness power. And that's just so important, because it's the striving which actually stops you attaining those jhanas. That is the problem, striving. Because to strive, you're under control. The jhanas, you have to let go. Two totally different paths. And the problem is that people are just scared of letting go. We haven't learned that. We think, oh, just fall asleep. Oh, everything will fall apart. Oh, mine will wander all over the place. And so, you know, they let go. It does wander all over the place to start off with. You do get a bit lazy to start off with, but carry on, wait for a little while. See what happens. I mean, that's all the teachers used to say, that Ajahn Chah. He'd wave his hand up and down like this and say, this is a leaf on a tree, it only moves because of the wind. If the wind stopped, it wouldn't stop straight away. It would just take some time and then it would become perfectly still. And so that's the nature of the human mind. It's, if you want something, that's the wind. Craving, wanting. In fact, craving is far too hard a word. Usually like wanting, desire. Wanting something, even something good, that causes the mind to move. So you don't get anything, except frustration. But if you can, have the courage to let go. And part of letting go is kindness, loving kindness, metta, compassion. just open the door of your heart to what's happening now. And just after a little while, the mind stops. It becomes very still. And when that becomes still, it's from stillness you get disappearing. That's the cause of no desire, stillness, things disappear. And one of the things which disappear, of course, is your five senses with your body. So you close your eyes, and sight disappears. Smell, taste, easy to let go of. And the physical feelings of the body and sound, those are the two hardest. Physical feelings of the body, that just by a lot of times using the breath is one of the best ways. It doesn't have to be the breath. You know, sometimes you can let go of the body, allow it to be so still. But also just the breath is one of the best ways, because you focus on the breath, that's all you've got, you can't feel anything else in your body. Until eventually, once the breath gets very soft, that disappears as well. And that's why even the Buddha said the thing which can get into the first jhana is sound. Sound, just because it is a defense mechanism put into our mind that if we always warn of the approaching tiger or the snake through the slither of the leaves in the forest, it's always the sound which is our last form of defense. And it's sound which can take us out of a coma, which can actually wake us up from the sleep. That's why we have the bells and the ding, 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 ding for fire alarms. So, because of that, it's really clear to me that you have to be a jhana, the five senses have to vanish. It's not about will, because if you're willing, if you're doing something, you're trying, it doesn't work.
Just to make it clear, if people who have, they claim that they have jhana and the body is the base,
yeah.
You would say it's upachara samadhi?
Yeah, well, probably not even that. It's just a nice pleasant feeling, nice and peaceful, calm, pleasant, but it's not the jhanas. So, you know, I know that thing Kaja Bamali said, oh, you're making it way. No, this is because he follows my teachings, or Buddhist teachings, I would say. And to say that, he said, oh, it's just making it too hard for others, you should be more compassionate. But look, you can't sort of say like enlightenment, like anything is enlightenment, or anything is a stream winner. That's missing the point. You know, you can't say like an aircraft is a bird. It's an aircraft flying ahead over the moment. You know, you have to be truthful. And it's not making things difficult for people. It's actually making things possible. And it works after a while, because the problem is now that everybody in this, you know, for years, many people just stopped even talking about jhanas. They thought it wasn't necessary. And monks like myself come along and say, it's really necessary. You know, you show that it's really necessary to have jhanas to get sort of stage enlightenment. And now at least people have understood, yeah, it's part of the Eightfold Path. You can check it out for yourself. It's necessary. Now that we've managed to win that sort of battle, it's really important. Now everybody's coming onto the bandwagon and say, yeah, you know, jhanas are necessary, so I've got jhanas. And I mentioned that I went to two very prominent teachers in the United States, and they wanted to talk to me. I thought, you were Vipassana junkies. They said, no, because our teachers have now confirmed that jhanas is necessary, and so we're talking about jhana light, L-I-T-E. The first time I heard that. And what it really is just, yeah, accepting the jhanas are necessary, but lowering the bar to something it's really not. And you know, you can't do that. That's just both intellectual dishonesty, but it's not treating the people you're teaching with respect. Of course you can do it. But eventually, just, you know, you find that trying to get there, wanting it, that's the obstacle. So what do you do instead? You just sit here and let go. And have the patience. ready to let it happen. But don't get frustrated, because that's, you know, more self, more me. I'm a failure, I'm great, I'm hopeless, I'm better. And that's the sort of stuff which, you know, forms the basis of letting go. And simple things like kindness, compassion. Beautiful basic teachings of the Buddha. Being kind to yourself. Being really kind. Kindness is a part of letting go. And then everything starts to happen. They get very peaceful. And people attain these things. When they stop trying.